evangelicalism is not interested in wisdom. It's interested in winning. It's interested in growth. It's interested in all of the things that come with a kind of modern capitalistic expression of Christianity.
Hello and welcome. You're listening to the podcast where being labeled a heretic is a good thing. We're starting conversations about God, politics, sexuality, spiritual formation, how we got here, and how to move forward post-evangelicalism. Nothing is off limits in our conversations with scholars, seekers, activists, and writers in our quest to uncover the heart of faith. Welcome to Holy Heretics.
Hi, folks. It's Gary Allen back from a little bit of a spring hiatus. And today I'm joined by beloved author Jonathan Merritt to discuss his journey out of evangelicalism, but more importantly, to discuss our collective responsibility in shaping the next generation of Christ followers so that they don't have to overcome the pitfalls, trauma, pain, and frankly, a lot of the weirdness that is growing up evangelical. I don't know if you've stopped to consider it, but a lot of us in the deconstruction community, gosh, we're getting older. We have kids, and our faith journey is no longer about us, but about our children and their children. I'll be honest, I don't want my kids to have the same kind of spiritual experience I did growing up. And so leaving evangelical Christianity for me is often about establishing a new spiritual legacy for my family. I want my kids to be inclusive from the get-go, to be loving from the get-go, to realize faith is more about compassion and contemplation than certainty. And to help us with this critical conversation, to help us raise up a generation of Christians who look a lot different than we did, I'm joined today by Jonathan Merritt. Jonathan is one of America's most popular writers on issues of faith and culture. He is an award-winning contributor for The Atlantic, a contributing editor for The Week, and a regular columnist for Religious News Service. In addition to the written word, Jonathan contributes commentary to television, print, and radio news outlets. He has been interviewed by ABC World News, CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, NPR, PBS, CBS 60 Minutes, and Holy Heretics. Jonathan holds a Master of Divinity from Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary, a Master of Theology from Emory University's Candler School of Theology, and he's done additional graduate work focused on ascetical theology at the General Theological Seminary of the Episcopal Church. He currently happily resides in New York City. He's an aspiring dog dad, a college football fanatic, and he's intolerable before coffee. Well, Jonathan, it's great to have you on the show today. I'm really looking forward to the conversation.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much for having me on. I've wanted to be on Holy Heretics for a while, so I'm going to check this one off the to-do list. Thanks for letting me be a part.
Wow, that just gave me goosebumps here. So I feel like we are a little bit of kindred spirits. We both grew up in the evangelical South. We are both sons of preachers. We've both matured beyond the religious fundamentalism and spiritual communities of our youth. And maybe to provide some context for the conversation, do you mind sharing just a little bit about your personal and spiritual journey from being a kid in the Deep South, Bible Belt, preacher's kid, to someone who has now become a voice of hope for so many people who have been marginalized by the evangelical movement?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I grew up just about as evangelical as you could be. I went to a Christian school. I spent, you know, 3 or 4 times a week in church. I was really a true believer. As you mentioned, you know, I'm the son of an evangelical pastor. In fact, you know, my dad was and is a prominent religious leader. He's a televangelist. He is a a mega church pastor. When I was growing up, he was president of the Southern Baptist Convention. When I left his home, I went to Liberty University, Jerry Falwell's Liberty University. My dad was on the board of trustees there. So, you know, I was a kind of bona fide card-carrying member of the next generation of the religious right, and you know, grew up reading everyone from John Piper to Ann Coulter, and that was my life. I ate, drank, and slept evangelicalism. But as I, you know, became aware that I was gay and that there was nothing I could do to not be gay, I knew I needed to find a new place to go. At the time, I was serving as a kind of teaching pastor and creative director at my dad's church in Georgia. I had just finished up a Master of Theology from Emory University, their Candler School of Theology. And I said, okay, I need to pack it up and go somewhere. And through this kind of weird series of events, which we can certainly talk more about, I decided New York City, that's where I should be. And so I packed up a minivan with everything that I owned and enough money in my pocket to pay for what I thought would be about 8 months of rent, and kind of assumed after that I might end up back in Georgia once I ran out of money. And that was about 10 and a half years ago. Wow. So I here for a long, long time. And being in New York gave me the space to explore other possibilities for who I could be. Not just as like a gay person, but as a person of faith. And so, you know, there was a real moment in time where, you know, a kind of should I stay or should I go moment. And I decided to stay, not in evangelicalism, but definitely rooted in the Christian tradition. The way that I have said it is that, like, I really appreciate so much of my evangelical heritage, despite all of the toxicities and the difficulties and the things that I've had to pay, you know, a therapist a lot of money to come to understand.
Right.
But I'm just finding God in other spaces and places outside of the borders of evangelicalism these days.
And what are those spaces and places for you? Because that's also very similar to my journey. I found a home in Episcopalianism, which I had never even heard of until I left evangelicalism. For you, what does that new space and place look like?
You know, well, I grew up thinking that mainline Protestantism, of which Episcopalianism is a part, was post-Christian. You know, it was like evangelicals are sort of taught to believe that evangelical Christianity is Christianity, and that everything outside of it is just sort of like, you know, a slip and slide to you know, God's eternal furnace. And that was not my experience. I've come to find real vibrant spiritual community inside mainline Protestantism. As I go to these churches, I speak at a lot of churches, you know, the PCUSA, the ECLA, the Episcopal Church. I live on the campus of an Episcopal seminary, and I've gotten to know a lot of people from that tradition here and have just come to see the gifts, the spiritual gifts that in many ways are unique to those communities. And related to that, I think liturgy, sacramentalism, these sort of historical expressions of Christianity, by the way, that predate evangelicalism by several centuries, those expressions of Christianity for me have held life and renewal and have stimulated my imagination for what it could look like to be Christian in a new way. But I will say the one place that maybe has most surprised me is the Christian life and the spiritual vibrancy that I have found inside of myself through contemplation, through being alone, through spiritual listening to the voice of God as I know it, as I hear it, as it comes to me. And so, you know, I was taught that those things were sort of dangerous or pagan or could open the door to something that might hurt me or harm me. And I've actually found them to be places of spiritual renewal. Mm-hmm. And so contemplative practice for me has been kind of a mechanism by which I feel like I've been drawn into the heart of God.
Mm. I love that. Do you know Karen? I think I'm going to say her name right. Karen Swallow Pryor or Karen Pryor Swallow from Liberty?
Yes, Karen Swallow Pryor. Sure, sure.
So it's interesting that you say that because yesterday she had a really great post on social. I know Karen still identifies as evangelical, and obviously there's nothing wrong with that. But there was a great conversation about what it looks like to be post-evangelical. And there were so many people, as you said, that were responding like, well, wait a minute. If you leave evangelicalism, you have left Christianity. And it was really sad for me and to read that because I thought, oh my God, that really is the mindset that culture and that community are unfortunately believe that they are kind of the only remnant of believers left. And I jumped in very hopefully compassionately and empathetically and said, hey guys, like there's an entire deep water of spirituality beyond evangelical Christianity. And the differences are, you know, you kind of move from knowing to unknowing, to fear to love, from being kind of an insider, outsider group. I like to describe evangelicalism like you get in by belief and then they get you out by belief. Can you expand a little bit more about the freedom and the depth and the ways in which your spirituality have grown in this new season in your life?
Yeah, you know, I would say the first thing, I always tell people who are in evangelicalism who kind of have that point of view that evangelical Christianity equals Christianity, I always say, you know, there are two things that we can agree on because they're undeniable facts. You know, we can disagree on what's right or wrong on this doctrine or that doctrine or the best way to be Christian or the truest way to be Christian, right? We can have those conversations, which is exactly the type of conversation that evangelicalism is obsessed with and the exact type of conversation that I've become disinterested in. But we can have those. there are two undeniable facts. One, the majority of Christians who exist in the world right now are not that kind of Christian. That's a fact. Mm. And number two, evangelical Christianity is a very new way of being Christian. That if you go back to the 11th century or the 13th century, nobody believed what the evangelical believes. Nobody was a Christian in the way that evangelicals are Christian. Now, that doesn't make it a wrong way to be Christian. It's simply acknowledging that your way of being Christian is both new and that most Christians have not been that type of Christian throughout our entire history and also today in this current moment. And so, you know, when you start to think about that, you begin to realize that if your way of being Christian is the only way of being Christian, then Christians haven't existed since at the very earliest, say around the 1700s, and only a minority of Christians today are actually Christians, which is sort of a mind-boggling proposition. The gift is that those other ways of being Christian, it's like they have ancient wisdom because they've sat with these questions much longer than evangelicalism has. You know, evangelicalism is sort of it's like a child, right? It's like having a conversation about existential reality with a 14-year-old. And so it's not that
I have a 14-year-old, by the way,
probably
and it doesn't work.
You
trust
probably
me.
Know. So it's like you probably have conversations with your child and it's not that everything they say is untrue. It's not that they don't have any good questions. It's not that at all. It's just that there is, you know, there's a lot of passion and exuberance for these types of conversations. But there isn't that hard-won wisdom that comes with sitting with these questions century after century after century, and allowing your kind of the posture of your mind in this tradition to sort of rub up against these questions and lead you to some potential answers. And so when you enter into these Christian spaces that have a little bit of age on you, you know, it's like sitting down with an elder, right? Who has seen things change over time and has found what is enduring and has decided to sort of hold on to that. But evangelicalism is not interested in wisdom. It's interested in winning. It's interested in growth. Mm-hmm. It's interested in all of the things that come with a kind of modern capitalistic expression of Christianity. And so to begin to let go of those things, despite the gifts that evangelicalism can offer the Christian community at large, and to begin to explore those deep grooves that exist outside of evangelicalism, whether it's Protestantism or Catholicism or the Orthodox tradition. I mean, my spiritual director is Jesuit, and you know, his perspective is Ignatian, right? So his perspective for spiritual formation is centuries old, and practitioners have sat with that and they've worked with those tools and they've passed those tools on. It wasn't like they read it in an Andy Stanley book, you know, 6 weeks ago. And so there's a real gift in those kinds of old ways and those old paths. And I find them to be really, really beautiful. I'm finding a lot of life there.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it was John Shelby Spong who said, the church is like a swimming pool. Most of the noise comes from the shallow end. And I think that's a great description at times of evangelicalism. As you said, a very new movement. It's also a movement that hasn't necessarily appreciated not only tradition and history, as you say, but the deep spiritual waters that are required to move further and further into unknowing, or from, you know, moving from certainty to contemplation. Mm-hmm. And that's actually what I have found to be so beautiful in my post-evangelical journey, is I'm no longer anxious about trying to have the right ideas. I'm no longer anxious about trying to control my walk. I'm more open. I'm more free. I now see God beyond the borders of my faith and my Christian community. And to me, it's been a great blessing to mature beyond and graduate beyond that. As you said, nothing wrong with it, but it does feel like kind of the kindergarten level of Christianity, very needed. But if you stay there, I do feel like that you have become stunted in your path.
Well, you know, some people could understand this. I think if a lot of people who are like you, Gary Allen, and like me, we've read and been shaped by Richard Rohr, and particularly his book, Falling Upward. And evangelicalism is sort of classic first half of life spirituality. It's not bad. In fact, I think about the place that I am today. I can't pretend that I would be in this place apart from where I've come from, that I grew up in a community that, despite its many flaws, gave me containers for spirituality, gave me kind of a way to orient myself in the world of Christian spirituality. But at some point, all of that begins to break down. And you begin to see the nuance and the complexity and the mystery of life. And there are a lot of people that begin to come face to face with that nuance and complexity and mystery, and rightfully are afraid of what might happen if they open and unclench their fists and reach for those things. And so instead, they turn their back on them and they return to their flashcards and their apologetics books, right? And they just go back and reread Lee Strobel, and that's where they decide to live their lives. It doesn't mean that they're not Christian, right? They're Christian in a different way. But I think as you and I have come to see, because we've both been them and us, and they've only been them. That we have seen the expansiveness and the gifts that come with transcending that kind of, you know, rigid, certainty addicted fundamentalism.
Mm-hmm. Yep, exactly. So, Jonathan, you have a new book titled My Gunkle and Me. I think I said that right.
You sure did.
All right, awesome. So, what's the story behind that book and kind of based on this conversation of moving towards something bigger and better? What do you hope that the book accomplishes?
Well, you know, it's my first children's book. I'd never written a children's book before, but I kind of moved into this seminary, as I mentioned before, and there are a lot of families that live here. A lot of us are kind of post-evangelical people, figures, writers, pastors, post-evangelical, you know, professors, who were all sort of coexisting together. And those families became my chosen family or my found family here in New York. And, you know, families don't just gift us with belonging. They can also expand our imagination for who we can be in relation to each other. And those families invited me in and said, we want you to have a seat at our table. And not just any seat, right? But a seat with your name on it, a special seat, an honored seat, a celebrated seat, that you can offer gifts to our family and our children that we cannot offer because of who you are. And it expanded my imagination because, you know, I grew up in the Bible Belt and in evangelicalism. You know, queer people are sort of assumed to be threats to traditional families, threats to children.
Right.
And, you know, certainly I had never had a model for this kind of familial inclusion. And yet this is what was being offered to me. And it totally changed my life. And at the same time, I had been working on some children's books with friends and helping them with theirs and kind of remembering the joy of reading books as a kid myself. And I'd said to my friend Shauna down at our, we do a happy hour on Fridays here. And I said, you know, I'm thinking about writing a children's book. And she said, well, what would you write it about? And I said, well, that's the thing. I don't know yet. And she said, well, why don't you write it about being a gunkle? And it was just like, boom, you know, the light was illuminated. And I was like, that's it. That's the book. And so I started writing it the very next day. And it was the only thing I could think about. And I wrote a story about a kid named Henry Higgleston, who is struggling because he feels so different. And, you know, he sort of sticks out at school and he doesn't sort of conform in the way he walks and talks and dresses and the things that he's interested in. And his fabulous relative, his gunkle, comes for a visit with his dog, Jimmy Choo, in tow. And his gunkle takes him on an adventure where he sort of models for Henry that the things that make us different are the things that make us special. That, you know, for a lot of children, difference is a liability. Difference can lead to loneliness. Difference can lead to bullying. And so children have this heavy incentive to conform. They have a heavy incentive to deny what's different about them. And what this book does is it reminds children. And it's what Henry does ultimately. Not the gunkle is not the main character. It's really Henry is sort of the star of the show. Henry begins to transform and Henry comes to the realization that what makes him different is what makes him special. That that the thing that sets you apart is the thing that makes you you. And it's not just a gift that the universe has given to you. It's a gift that you can give to the world. And so, yes, I hope that it, you know, expands people's imagination for all the ways that, you know, queer family members can be a gift to all of us. But ultimately, what I hope is that children who read this book will begin to accept the uniqueness about themselves and offer it to the world around them as a special gift that only they can offer.
Wow. That's really beautiful. You know, it's interesting because your book made me think about some things that I really hadn't thought about before. We are at a stage now in the post-evangelical community where a lot of us have kids, and a lot of us are seeking to raise our kids different from how we were raised. And we're also in a phase where a lot of us are confused, sort of in spiritual no man's land. Can you speak to maybe some specific ways or practical ways that those of us in this community can raise our kids differently, can expose them to things that maybe we weren't exposed to, or at least point them toward a more inclusive, compassionate, empathetic way of being in the world?
Yeah. Well, you know, the so-called traditional family, like evangelicalism, is a relatively new way of being. Mm-hmm. David Brooks wrote a really good piece on that in The Atlantic, I believe, last year. And the idea that, like, the traditional family is sort of a Western concoction of the 20th century, largely of the 20th century, that you would have a mom and a dad, and the dad was sort of the breadwinner. And he would go off to work and the mom would stay home sort of tending to the cooking and cleaning, and they would raise their compliant children who would marry early and give them grandchildren and perpetuate the cycle. The so-called traditional family model is new. And one of the things that this new way of thinking about family says to us is that there really is one way to be family. That outside of this model, you sort of cease to be family. And so if you got a divorce, or you had an adoption, or you discovered infertility in your marriage, or if you had two parents of the same gender, well, you were sort of left out. You were sort of like less than. You sort of had a partial family, or you were kind of playing family, depending on the way that you sort of decided to arrange your family. But what many of us who left evangelicalism, which is sort of has this kind of cult of traditional family that sort of sits at its heart and uses, like, you know, Bible wallpaper to make it sound like, you know, this is what God intended. We grew up in that and we kind of broke out of it. We freed ourselves from that prison. And what we learned after we got out of jail is that family is not just a genetic or legal reality, but it's something you create. And that there's beauty in a wide range of expressions of family. Mm-hmm. And so if there are people who, let's say you're listening to this and you go, totally agree. I totally agree. There's a wide range of expressions of family. And now I'm raising my child to understand that so that they don't have to kind of unlearn all of the things that you know, I inherited in my evangelical upbringing. So what would we do? Well, there are lots of things you can do, but I'll give you two. A child cannot be what they do not see. Children operate with models. And so we have to give children models of diversity, models of inclusion, models of acceptance. I didn't have those models, you know, so
right.
I didn't have a model for a gay family member being fully incorporated into my family. You know, any gay family members that I had were closeted. And so, you know, we didn't really have that model. And so I really struggled without a model to kind of become the person that I am today. I had to build those models as an adult. And that's a really hard task. Well, you can give your kids those models so that they don't have to build models for a unique, diverse, and inclusive family. The way you can do that, one way you can do that is to incorporate the diverse members who already exist in your current family. Yeah. There are people in your family. You may have biracial couples. You may have somebody who's single in their older years. You might have a queer family member, right? You may have my uncle who's deaf. You have somebody who has a disability. Incorporating those diverse family members, inviting them in, not just to orbit your immediate family, but to integrate into your immediate family is a gift. Mm. You can begin to see that there's a flexibility, that you can make a decision to expand the way that your family looks and the way that it operates. The other one is if you look around and go, yeah, well, basically everybody in my family is the same and we don't have any biracial couples or people who are single or queer or disabled. Well, the good thing is you can invite, you don't have to incorporate, you can invite mm-hmm. diverse members into your family. Mm-hmm. And that's also a gift that you can go out and find the guy, you know, there's a guy living three doors down and he's living with his husband and, you know, their families aren't around anymore. They don't accept them for holidays or mm-hmm. They live across the continent somewhere. You can invite them in to be a part of your family, just like the families here have invited me into their families. I have a godson who lives one building over, and he has taught me so much that I didn't even know I needed to learn. I've had, you know, people say, hey, can you watch our kids this weekend? Can you take our boys to dinner tonight? Mm-hmm. And just, you know, get curious about their lives and their schools and the things that they're wrestling with. Hey, my son is wrestling with something. Can you take him to get a cup of coffee or take a walk around the block? I think you have some wisdom to share with him. They mm-hmm. invited me in and said, you will be a part of this family. And wow. I have spent Christmas with them and major holidays with them. And I have cried on their couch and we have grieved things together. And that has been a gift to me, but I believe it's also been a gift to them and to their children who are watching the courageous decisions that their parents are making and will be better equipped to reimagine bigger and more beautiful families when they come of age as well.
Wow. That's freaking amazing. Thank you for sharing that. My wife and I we've got three kids. We've done our best to do some of that. And yet, as we said off air, we still live in a very white, very homogenous evangelical subculture. And it's been difficult to find difference, to find diversity, to find people who want to be a part of that. So thank you for encouraging me and convicting me to do likewise with my kids. I want to end with maybe one serious question and then follow up with a couple of fun get to know you questions, if you don't mind.
Sounds great.
When you look at the next generation of Christians that will follow this wave of faith deconstruction, those children that right now are going to read My Gunkle and Me, those children that are impacted by these diverse and beautiful and inclusive new, quote, families, what do you see and what gives you hope for the future of Christianity lived out in these new bodies and these new people?
Well, you know, something I see broadly in the kind of ex-evangelical movement and the deconstructionist movement, I see it even in my own church. I go to a kind of post-evangelical liturgical, we're an ecumenical interdenominational church here in New York City called Good Shepherd. The way that I describe it is spiritual stubbornness. we have every reason to say, to hell with this. Yeah. The whole damn thing. Mm-hmm. To just throw it all in a box and sit it out by the mailbox, right? To just let the trash truck come along and take it away. It is broken. We don't have to tape it together. We don't have to sort through to find what's good. We have plenty of reasons. No one would blame you from walking away from religion, from spirituality, from these types of conversations. But there's a spiritual stubbornness that I find exists with so many of a kind of this next wave of Christians. They won't be pushed out. They won't allow their bad experiences, their toxic encounters with, bad behaving leaders to turn them into cynics or to make them bitter or to deprive them of the gifts, both of spiritual community, whether that exists inside of a church or somewhere else, and the gifts of spiritual questions, spiritual wondering and wandering. And that to me is a testament to the kind of courage and staying power that so many fellow seekers have developed along the way. It's something that I wanted to put actually in my book, in My Gunkle and Me. There's a scene in it. In fact, I'll read it to you, a very short scene where it was important to me that as this Gunkle figure and Henry are spending their weekend together, that there would be a faith expression. You know, it's countercultural that a queer character, particularly in a children's book, but generally would be a person of deep faith because so many of them have been treated so poorly by faith communities that they're often angry with, antagonistic toward, or apathetic toward faith and spirituality. And so I wanted to show that. I thought it was really important. And so there's a section in the book that says this. It says, "At church the next morning, my Gunkle sings loudly. He prays and gives thanks, and he does it devoutly. His bright colored outfit makes two women stare. When we pass, they both snicker, but he doesn't care." And I think that sort of displays that spiritual stubbornness that we will continue to show up in these spaces. And it doesn't matter if you recognize us. It doesn't matter if you claim our Christianity is Christian enough. It doesn't matter if you're concerned for our spiritual health or if you think that we are on the fast track to some post-mortem inferno. We're unconcerned now with the ways that that community tries to coerce us. And we're willing to stick around to find healthier communities, to forge healthier communities, and to find spiritual vibrancy despite our bad experiences. And for me, I don't know anything that could give me more hope than that.
Wow. I feel like the Southern preacher, it came out in you in that. Like, I was like about to say amen, and that was amazing. That was awesome.
Well, you can take the boy out of the South, as they say, I suppose.
Yeah. All right. So before I let you go, I want to ask you just some really quick kind of get to know you questions, if you don't mind.
I love that. Great.
All right. Number one, what's the best part of living in New York City?
Oh my goodness. Well, okay. So I'm a big Broadway guy. I love Broadway. And, you know, you can't do everything in New York, right? You can't go to every art opening. You can't go to every museum. You can't go to every Broadway play. You can't do everything. You have to choose because it's, you don't have enough time and you don't have enough money.
Right.
And so the one thing that I decided was, if and when I leave this city one day, whether, you know, I leave in a moving van or a body bag, I would leave this city and say, I would not say, boy, I wish I would have seen more theater. I wish I would have seen more Broadway. So I see most everything in a season. Not everything. Some things I used to see everything in a Broadway season. And then I was like, yeah, some of it just doesn't interest me and I don't need to pay $100 to sit in that room. So, now I see probably about 75% of everything that comes onto Broadway in a given season. And it's like the joy of my life to be captive in a space where I am forced to turn off my phone and to watch art be created live. And of course you're seeing it. You're seeing the best theater on earth. I mean, you can't go anywhere. I'm sure people in London would argue the West End rivals Broadway, but it's the best theater on earth. And there are things that take a lot of money to exist on stage that you just couldn't get off the ground anywhere else, but they exist here. There are so many times. I mean, I remember one year, this was pre-pandemic. I went down to the West Village. This wasn't on Broadway, but I went down to the West Village and they had underwater puppetry. I kid you not. And you sat in front, there was a grand piano in a pitch black room. And the curtain came up and you were looking through glass into kind of a big aquarium. Mm-hmm. And these sort of puppets dove down in the water. And for an hour and a half, while this grand piano played gorgeous music, you were watching choreographed puppetry underwater. And it was so beautiful. It could almost make you cry. And I feel silly even sort of describing it, right? Because most people who live elsewhere are like, you paid to watch underwater puppetry. But only in New York are you able to see these kind of these different and varied art forms. And that's probably my favorite thing about New York City.
That's awesome. All right. Flip side, what's the worst part?
Well, it's become so unsustainable.
Yeah.
There are neighborhoods in New York that the average one bedroom it's over $6,000 a month for rent. I don't know how people can afford to live here. I've been really blessed to find a few places that are, you know, semi-affordable, but so much of my money is spent to breathe the air. And you know, you go down and you want a cocktail and your cocktail is $24 and you want a hamburger and your hamburger is $33. And, you know, it has the way that the cost of living from top to bottom has ballooned in the last couple of years has really made this city almost unlivable. And that breaks my heart because New York has always been expensive. But if you really wanted to be here, you could do it.
Yeah.
You could find your place. You go a little further out. You could live in Brooklyn. Now Brooklyn's more expensive than Manhattan in many cases.
Wow.
You know, so you're really being pushed out unless you are ultra wealthy and privileged. And the thing that made New York, New York, was that you had struggling artists and actors and caterers and people just sort of doing odd jobs and trying to figure it out. And those people are increasingly across the river or they're moving to other cities because this city has continued to structure itself in a way to say, look, unless you work on Wall Street or you work for a tech company or you work for one of the big consulting firms, we're really not going to save a place for you here. And that makes me sad.
Yeah. Absolutely. Third question. We're almost done. What is your favorite Southern comfort food that you miss the most being in New York?
Well, I'll tell you, I don't even have to think about it. biscuits.
Biscuits. Yeah.
I mean, you know, people think a biscuit is a biscuit is a biscuit, and it's just not true. And you know, I'm used to a traditional Southern style fluffy biscuit, and a lot of the biscuits here are flaky biscuits, which is not Southern style, or they're what you'd call a drop biscuit, which is not really flaky or fluffy. it tends to be a little more, you know, dense. It's just like a ball of dough that was like cooked up. Additionally, in the South, you can find white lily. White lily is like the flour that makes definitively the best Southern biscuits. And you really can't find white lily flour here. So that's a struggle. So there are just a lot of things that go into making a biscuit that, you know, I used to live next to a place. And when I first moved to Brooklyn, I was in South Williamsburg and there was a place there called Pies and Thighs. I don't even know if it's still there, but it's a little place called Pies and Thighs. And man, they knew how to make, they had biscuits and gravy. And I don't even know how many pounds I gained eating that because I would go back and I would remember my grandmother. My grandmother, I'd stay at her house. She'd make biscuits in the morning with gravy and then biscuits at night with dinner. Twice a day, she'd make biscuits from scratch. And those biscuits, they were a little larger than hers, but they were just about as close as you could get to grandma's biscuits. In New York, if there's a biscuit on the menu, you can probably skip it.
That's awesome. Yeah, my Nana made the most incredible, unique biscuits ever. And my mom has tried to mirror and model that. She has the recipe. She uses the same flour. Still not Nana's biscuits. Still not Nana's biscuits. So, yep, I get it. All right. Last question. I don't really want this conversation to end, but I'll end with this. What's next for Jonathan Merritt?
You know, this is a really good question, and I wish that I had a good answer for you. I don't know. I think this is the question that is at the center of my own life right now. For so many years, I've been writing Christian content and, you know, kind of existing in this space. And I do a lot of that now. I travel around. I preach at a lot of churches. I write a lot, not as much as I used to. I used to write a ton of columns. I don't do as much of that anymore. But I'm really like, okay, God, what is next? Is this next? Is now next? Or is next something different? And I don't know the answer to that, but I'm trying to figure that out. So, you know, I'm 41 years old now, and I'm trying to think from 40 to 50, what will I do? Do I want to just double down on the thing that I'm doing now? Or do I want to try to recreate something new, you know? And even if I keep doing what I'm doing, I've thought about launching a Substack, which I already have a newsletter on my website, but thought about changing that to Substack and writing more consistently on Substack. Yep. I've thought about writing another children's book. I've thought about writing another adult book. I just finished a lecture series at Emory that is on kind of reading the Bible through the lens of trauma. And I could imagine that becoming a book. Once I get finished, I'll be wrapped up with that in the next month or two. So there's like a lot of possibilities. And I feel like I'm standing at the fork in the road saying, okay, which way do I walk? And I'm just waiting until I hear go. And then and then I'll make a choice. But right now I'm in that, in the discernment process. So we'll see.
Yeah. Jonathan, seriously, one of the beauties, blessings and humble moments of being a podcaster is to connect with people like you, to share space with people like you. And I seriously mean that. Thank you so much for being on the show. Thank you for sharing your heart, for your testimony, for your witness, for your life. Where can we find your book, My Gunkle and Me? Obviously on Amazon, and maybe more importantly, where else can listeners connect with you and continue to follow your journey?
Well, I love to connect on Instagram. I post a lot there. You can also subscribe to my newsletter on my website, jonathanmerritt.com. Buying the book from Target is helpful. Amazon is helpful. The thing is that these are the kinds of books, and I know your listener, they know that this is the kind of story that we should be telling our children, that that the world we will create is a result of the stories we choose to tell our children. And these are the kinds of stories we should choose to tell our children. And if you believe that, you have to support that.
Yep.
And the only way to do that, and especially in an age when these kinds of stories make people afraid, these are the kinds of stories that are being attacked right now, is you have to prove to retailers that it's worth the risk of carrying them. And the only way to do that is to order them. So I say it not just for me, but for the sake of better stories. Go online, please buy this book, buy a stack of them for your friends who have kids, for your neighbor's kids, for your stepkids, for your godkids, or, you know, I wrote it for kids of all ages. So buy it for yourself and get in touch with your inner child. Buy a whole stack if you feel so moved, and do it wherever fine books are sold, as they say.
Love it. Love it. Well, Jonathan, thanks so much. Happy Good Friday. And I look forward to the next time we get a chance to talk.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you for joining us. This episode was produced by the Sophia Society and written by Gary Allen Taylor. Music is by Faith and Foxholes. If you need more resources to guide your spiritual journey, head to sophiasociety.org for articles, resources, and our free ebook on faith deconstruction. And before we go, will you consider joining us on Patreon? Your partnership allows us to continue creating this sacred space for seekers like you. By becoming a patron, you gain early access to each podcast episode, as well as premium content, and an exclusive invitation to join our monthly online community. Simply sign up at patreon.com/holyheretics. See you next time.